Hello, this is the Physics 142 lecture for September 7th, 2010. I'd like to first start out by apologizing again for my travel this semester, so I hope this mode of presentation works for you. In the past, I've done it for other classes, and they seem to think it was okay. I haven't done it for several lectures in a row, but hopefully this will work out okay. I have a few things that I wanted to tell you. First of all, workshops begin the week of September 13th, so you don't have workshops this week, the week of September 7th. Problem set 1 is due Thursday, September 9th. I'd like you to try to keep up with the problem sets. I think it's very important in this class, in fact, to do that. So I'm out of town, and we will not be meeting in Hoyt, so obviously you can't hand the problem set in to me there. So what I'll do is put a box outside my office door before I leave, and you can just put the problem sets in there, and I'll ask the TAs to pick them up on the morning of Friday, September 10th. So that'll give you at least through Thursday evening if you want to have it to work on the problem set. My office door is bachelor room my office is bachelor room 203E, so if you haven't found that yet, if you come into bachelor room off the quad and you hang a right and go past the stairs into the through the double doors, you and just keep going, you'll find my office is the last office on the right. Also, you know, there are a couple of things we lose with this mode of presentation, one of which is the fact that I can't do demos during the lecture, which is a shame. The other issue is that it's hard for you to ask me questions. So we can deal with the latter one. I'll do some extra set of demos probably when I return and demonstrate a few of the things we've been talking about. The other thing I'll do, or I certainly also will have email contact, and I want you to feel free to email me with questions. And just a fair warning, when I get a question that I think is a reasonable question that other people may also learn from, I will sanitize the question, removing identifying information, and basically rebroadcast it to the class along with my answer. So another thing you can do to try to get some questions answered, we have TA office hours are scheduled for Monday from 2:30 to 3:30 in Bausch & Lomb 426, and Tuesday from 10 to 11, Bausch & Lomb 304. If these turn out not to be good times, it may be that we'll choose to actually change those times, but for now that's what they are. So if you would be kind enough to go to slide 2 for the accompanying PDF slides for this lecture. At our first class meeting on September 2, we started looking at electrostatics, and the force of electrostatics is very similar to the force of gravitation, except there are two types of charge instead of the one type of charge that we have for gravitation. And there are different ways to see this, but one way is to see that at least we have both attraction and repulsion in electrostatics. And the simplest way to model a force which has both attraction and repulsion is to have it have two different types of the charge, if you want to think about it that way. In making a model, if you have only a single type of charge, you end up either having to have it attractive or repulsive, but you can't really have it be both. So we did a demo in the last class. If you go to slide 3, we did a demo using something called an electroscope. And the electroscope consists of a conducting rod, and by conductor I mean that charge flows freely, electric charge will flow freely. And to this rod was a very thin and light gold leaf that was attached. And then We took a substance, a lucite rod, and rubbed it with silk, and it turns out that since different atoms have different electro affinities or different probability of holding on to electrons, you actually, by rubbing two different materials together, you can actually deposit charge, remove electrons from one material and leave them on the other. And this, if you've ever done laundry and taken things out of a dryer, this is something that you know well. It's basically static cling. At any rate, so if we take a lucite rod that's rubbed with silk, it has an electric charge, and we can then rub it on this conductor. The charge flows freely, so the charge then distributes across the conductor. And if we look at slide 4, if you look up at the top where we have our electroscope conductor in gold foil, as we deposit the charge, let's assume it's positive in this case, as we deposit positive charge on the gold foil, the positive charge repels the other positive charges. So if the positive charge is distributed along the post and the gold foil, something in the fashion of what we have in the figure to the right at the top of page 4 of the slides, then the gold foil is light enough that, in fact, it will be pushed away from the rod itself due to this electrostatic repulsion. And the amount of electrostatic repulsion will determine the degree to which this rod, the gold foil, is repelled from the conducting rod. So if we go back to slide 3, we can take a different type of rod rubbed with a different material, and we can find that if we approach the electroscope with that rod, in fact, it causes the gold foil to drop. So a way to think about that is if we have a different electric charge on the rubber rod, then it will attract the positive charge that is on the electroscope, and all of that positive charge, or much of it, will begin to flow up toward the top of the conductor, basically pulling the charge off of the gold foil in the lower part of the electroscope, and that will reduce the repulsion of the gold foil to the electroscope, and the gold foil will begin to drop. So this is a way of demonstrating that we have both, we have quantities within electrostatics which can cause both an attraction and a repulsion. And so this is a way of demonstrating that electrostatics has two different types of charges. So if we now go back to slide 2, we assume that, or we say that we have two types of charge, then it's important to figure out how the force varies between the charge. And our friend Coulomb did this and came up with what's called Coulomb's law. So Coulomb's law gives the force between two charges, and here on slide 2 we have two charges, Q1 and Q2, and Q1 and Q2 are separated by a vector R(1,2). R(1,2), you know, it has both a magnitude and a direction, and in fact it has a direction going from Q1 to Q2 in this case, although that's not so important in this instance. At any rate, the force of charge 1 on charge 2 is given by Coulomb's law. It's proportional to the charges, Q1 and Q2, and inversely proportional to the distance between them, R(1,2), magnitude. So the force, F(1,2), it's a vector quantity, and we have a proportionality constant, which we call K. And Coulomb's law goes as KQ1Q2 over R12 squared. And it has a direction because it's a force, and it is along the line that joins the two charges. It's because of Newton's third law. For every force, there's an equal and opposite. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. If Q1 pushes on Q2, Q2 pushes on Q1. The unit vector R(1,2) with the funny hat over it, that gives you just the direction along the line of sight between Q1 and Q2. So the proportionality constant basically sets the strength of the force, and this is once you decide what your units are and the charges and then distance, you then can go and measure how the force depends on how much charge you've got and what the distance is between the charges. And that's what really determines the size of K. So in MKS units, we, it comes up with a certain value, which you can look up in your book because I didn't write it here. Now, it's very, very important in physics. I mean, you need to take this very seriously. It's very important in physics to keep things really as confusing as possible for people who aren't physicists, because there's a little bit of job security in this. So the K that we're using here, it's usually a small case K. You don't want to confuse that with Boltzmann's constant. If you've used that, which is also a K, you sort of have to know by context which one you're talking about. It's also true that we don't want to just use K, because that's just a simple constant. So instead, we can disguise the fact that K is just this proportionality constant by rewriting it as 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, where epsilon naught is also a constant. So it is often you will see Coulomb's law written with the K, and often you will see it written as 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught times Q1, Q2 over R(1,2) squared. The constant epsilon naught is known as the permittivity of free space. And again, we call it that in part because if we just called it some proportionality constant that sets the strength of the force, it wouldn't sound as cool as permittivity. So permittivity is a cool word. At any rate, it's an epsilon naught, and it is permittivity of free space. So right now, I assume that really doesn't mean much to you, but one of the things that we'll see as we look at electric fields in materials, the electric field in a material is actually different from an electric field in a vacuum. And one way of quantifying that difference would be to actually change this constant. So one of the things that we'll see, is that the electric field in different materials can be quantified by different permittivities for the materials, or I guess the way in which a different materials affect the electric field will be given by the fact that they have different permittivities. And the permittivity of free space basically is the way of saying that's what the raw electric field is in a vacuum. So another thing that we talked about last time is that electric charge is conserved. It comes in little chunks. It comes in little chunks, so it's quantized. So it is conserved and quantized. By conserved, it means we can't create or destroy electric charge in a net sense in any reaction. And it's quantized. That's just a fact of nature. It seems that all free electric charges that we can find are integral multiples of the charge of the electron in magnitude. They can be both positive and negative, but they are always integral multiples of that value, which we symbolize with the E. And in the bottom of page 2, I emphasize the fact that it's an absolute value of E. That's sort of the value we mean when that's what we mean when we just say E. Usually you won't see it written with the absolute value signs, but just assume that it is then the charge of the electron, but the magnitude of it. So that's 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 coulombs. The symbol for coulomb is C. Don't confuse it with C as in the speed of light, or C as in a heat coefficient, or things like this. So again, is part of being a physicist is having to infer what you mean by some of the symbols by the context. So let's go to slide 4. So now we have Coulomb's law. We have just this simple little law that gives us some information about how the force between two charges is. And let's see if we can actually calculate something interesting with this. So in the middle of page 4, I have drawn schematically an electron orbiting around a proton given by the symbol P. And the electron orbits with a radius R sub 0, which is a symbol usually given for the Bohr radius. So if you recall ever doing the Bohr atom, then you probably solved for the Bohr radius. We're not going to be doing quantum mechanics right now, but basically if we assume that we're going to assume for our model of the hydrogen atom that the electron orbits the proton in a circle at a radius R sub 0. And the charge of the electron is minus E and the charge of the proton is plus E. So one question I'd like to do is sort of just for kicks, can we show that in fact, well, I would like to look at the difference between the electrostatic force between the proton and electron and the gravitational force between the proton and electron. Let's just look at a relative comparison, because in principle, the electron could be held to the proton by its gravitational force, right? So in order to do that, we'll just look at the magnitude of the electromagnetic force between them. That goes as kqq over r squared. K, the magnitude, K is 8.99 times 10 to the minus 9 newton meters per coulomb squared. E, the Q1, Q2 is just E squared, 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 squared. And R0 is 5.29 times 10 to the minus 11 meters, which is something I'm sort of pulling out of the blue, but we'll just take that as a given for the moment. So that's the force of electromagnetism, and what we find if we go to the top of slide 5, if you punch in those numbers, last time I did I got it about 8 times 10 to the minus 8 newtons. So that's pretty small force. And if we calculate the force of gravitation as G times mm over R squared, you can plug in the numbers, but when I did it, I got 3.6 times 10 to the minus 47 newtons. So that's a very, very tiny value. And so the ratio shown in the middle of page 5 on your slides, the ratio of the electromagnetic to gravitational force for the electron in the hydrogen atom held by the proton is about 2 times 10 to the 39th. So the gravitational force is vastly weaker than the electromagnetic force. Why is this? Well, people speculate. In fact, there's a lot of speculation. It's certainly something very fundamental about nature. The truth is, we really don't know why this is at the moment. There are ideas out there. One of the ideas people have is that there are dimensions that we are not that we cannot perceive, which are out there. We call them extra dimensions, and there are ways in which you construct theories such that you don't perceive those dimensions. And the thought is that perhaps gravitation more or less goes out, leaks into these other dimensions, while electromagnetism does not. And this can effectively sort of dilute the gravitational force relative to the electromagnetic force. That is one crazy idea. So this is just the way it is, but it's an interesting fact that the electromagnetic force is vastly stronger than the gravitational force. So while we're on that subject, I mean, let's think about it for a moment. If you just ask Joe Blow, you know, describe a force of nature, I think very often they would choose gravity, right? I mean, gravity is the force that makes it hard to go up and down stairs. It's the one that hurts your knees. It's the one you fight all day. It's sort of the one that you're aware of when you throw a ball. Gravity is the force that somehow occupies our awareness. And yet we're saying that it is 10 to the 39th times weaker than electromagnetism. So why is it that we're not bothered by electromagnetism all the time? And the answer for that is matter as a whole is electrically neutral to an extremely large degree. And if you separate charge, the force between those charges can be very, very big. But by and large, we don't have a lot of charge separation in nature, and that's why you don't normally become aware of it. When we have a mechanism that separates charge, say meteorologically, we get lightning, and you're very much aware of it. If you separate charge by rubbing your shoes on a carpet and then pet a poor dog or a cat, you zap them with the static charge, right? And so you're aware of it. So I think it's actually pretty amazing that we can have a force that's so strong in electromagnetism and yet have so few instances where that strength really comes into play relative to gravity. So at any rate, now let's go to we're in the middle of slide 5. Let's look at what the speed of the electron is if we were to assume that it moves in a circle. So we're going to pull out some basic Newtonian physics, and we know that the centripetal force toward the center, if we assume the proton does not move and that the electron is moving, the centripetal force will go as m times v squared over r for circular motion. So m is going to be the mass of the object moving in the circle, or the electron, and r will be the Bohr radius, the r sub zero, which we used earlier. And f sub c, the centripetal force, well, that is the force with which the proton's attracting the electron. So that is the electromagnetic force, or the Coulomb force. And if you now plug in these numbers and calculate them, you're going to find that the velocity of the electron at this orbit, if it's moving in a circle, is 2.2 times 10 to the 6 meters per second. So that's about 1% the speed of light. It's good to see it's 1% the speed of light, because that means we don't really need to be doing relativistic corrections to this. But if it were a big fraction of the speed of light, then we'd know that we have a real problem in assuming, making a classical calculation like this. At any rate, so that's the speed of the electron, 1% of the speed of light if it works under these assumptions. And now what I'd like to do, if you go to the top of slide 6, is to look at the energy that it takes to ionize the hydrogen atom. And just let me remind you, if you haven't had much chemistry, what we really mean by ionization is the energy it takes to remove the electron from the atom. So in this case, we're literally talking about the energy it takes to take the electron from where it is in the atom, which is at the Bohr radius, all the way out to infinity. And so now, I mean, we can't ever forget our mechanics. It all builds in here. So I'd like to remind you that what we really mean when we say that we want to know the energy it takes to remove that electron is we want to calculate the work that it takes to move the electron from the Bohr radius out to infinity. And, of course, I want, if you look in the second line of slide 6, work is the integral of the force dotted into the distance vector, or the what's the word I want? It's not arc length. If S is the path, the vector along the path. So why don't we just try to do this integral as simply as possible? In which case, what I'd like to do is say that I move the electron from the Bohr radius out to infinity along a radial line, for simplicity. Okay? And so the amount of work it takes, if you look at the equation denoted by the A in a circle, the amount of work it takes to move the electron from position R0 to infinity is the integral from R0 to infinity of F dot ds, where ds is a little differential element along the path that we take. Okay, and we are moving the electron from R0 out to infinity, so that little vector, that little ds, actually has a direction, which is along the radial direction. So differential ds is a little vector, but if I were to... It is also along dr, if because we're moving along the radius here, so... Differential ds is basically the same thing as dr. So the force that it takes, remember, if we're moving the electron out to infinity, we exert a force on the electron which is pulling outward toward infinity. And ds is also a little vector that is going outward. So f dot ds, F and ds are in the same direction, so that means that the dot product is just the magnitude of F times the magnitude of ds. Ds is along a radius, so a little differential ds is also the same as a little differential dr. So we're going to basically convert ds to dr. So if you go to where we have the A in a green circle and look at that equation, when we take the first step between F dot ds to the next step, F becomes K times the charge squared, E squared, over the distance squared, R squared, and F dot ds then just becomes F times dr. And the dot product just falls out because the vectors are in the same along the same direction. So K and E squared are both constants, so those pull out of the integral. So to the right of equation A in the green circle, all the way over to the right, we have K E squared, we pulled out of the integral, and we have the integral from R0 to infinity of 1 over R squared dr. So that integral is minus 1 over r, so we evaluate that between the limits of r0 to infinity, and we get the expression on the lower right-hand corner of page 6, that the amount of work it takes to move the electron from r0 to infinity is ke squared times, in parentheses, minus 1 over infinity, which is basically 0, minus a minus 1 over r0. So... we end up then at the top of page 7, the amount of work is ke squared over r0, which we now can calculate. And when you do, if you plug in the MKS units for K and coulombs and D the R0 in meters, then you will get 4.3 times 10 to minus 18 joules, because if you're in MKS units, that's the energy unit you get. And we can convert a joule to an electron volt, which is a unit of energy. And the reason I convert it to electron volts is that's sort of the that's the relevant energy for atomic things, basically. Chemical reactions or adjustments in the energy levels for electrons typically happen at the 10 to hundreds of electron volts range. So it's a very convenient energy unit for a lot of what we'll be doing, anything that involves the atomic world. So I want to change the joules, 4.3 times 10 to minus 18 joules, into electron volts. And when you do that conversion, and I hope you all are very good at doing basic unit conversions, I strongly recommend you use the factor label method. And if you don't know how to do that, I suggest you actually go Google the factor label method right now and learn how to do it. At any rate, so we can calculate the amount of work in electron volts, and we find that it's 26.9. Now, if we were in class right now, I would basically ask you, how many of you actually know what the ionization energy of hydrogen, what it happens to be, what's the right value? And the right value is about 13.6 electron volts. So 26.9 electron volts is really not that far off from 13.6. So first of all, that's fairly impressive. Secondly, I'd like you to actually ask yourself, gee, why don't I know that number? Or what most of you would look at me and go, why in the hell would I know that number? I mean, why would I know the ionization energy of hydrogen? And why do I care? It's the simplest atom. And the essence of the system, the essence of the atomic system is all there. You've got the electron orbiting this proton. The basic force is electromagnetism. So it gives you the scale for atomic interactions. And since atomic interactions are really all you're talking about with chemistry, what chemistry is a rearrangement of electrons and nuclei in an electrostatic sort of sense. I mean, it's electrostatics plus quantum mechanics, basically. And all you're doing in a chemical reaction is taking one set of configurations and reconfiguring a little bit, and whether that takes energy or releases energy depends on the endpoints. But it's all electrostatic rearrangement, basically. You can think of it that way. So all of those things are going to give you energy releases that are on the order of the ionization energy of hydrogen. So it's on the order of tens to hundreds of electron volts. So if you take a little pile of TNT and you rearrange it, basically let it explode, the energy release on a per molecule basis is on the order of tens to hundreds of electron volts. So that's why bombs go bang, because you have a lot of atoms doing that all at once. But if you do the same sort of exercise and you are using the strong nuclear force and you're asking what is the energy involved in rearranging nucleons in a nucleus, those energies, if you ask how much energy does it take to remove a nucleon from a nucleus, the kind of energy is millions of electron volts. That's the sets the scale for nuclear energies. So that's why if you were to make a bomb out of a little chunk of nuclear matter and you rearrange the nuclei, you get a cabal, right? Something much bigger than the little boom you got with the dynamite. It's like a million times bigger. And the basic reason has to do with these scales, which you more or less get from thinking about the ionization energy. So at any rate, 13.6 electron volts is the ionization energy for hydrogen, and that's really a pretty good number to always keep in mind. So we calculate, let's go back to where we started. We assume that the electron orbits the proton like as if it were orbiting on a circle at a distance from the proton of the Bohr radius. And we now calculated how much work it takes to remove that electron from that radius all the way out to infinity, and we found that it took 26.9 electron volts. Well, that is actually amazingly close to 13.6 electron volts, and I think we should be able to do a happy dance and feel pretty good about that. But it's actually, it's not quite right. It's too big, and so we did actually make a mistake. And again, if I were in class with you, I would basically at this point ask you to tell me what you think we did wrong. What we did wrong was the electron's already moving. Our calculation basically assumed the electron was at rest because we asked how much energy does it take to remove it from this radius out to infinity, but it already has energy. It's already moving. So we calculated the velocity a little while ago, so we have to assume that the electron already has energy. And we calculate, and so now we have to take that into account. So let's calculate the kinetic energy of the electron. And when we do, which is just, let's do classically, which works because we calculated the speed of it to be only 1% the speed of light. So we can use the classical equation for the kinetic energy. So at the bottom of page 7, the kinetic energy of the electron, 1/2 mv². And we put in the mass of the electron, which is 9 × 10⁻³⁹ kilograms, and the velocity that we calculated a little while ago. And in fact, we find you would calculate with kilograms and meters per second here, you would actually get a value in joules, which we then have to convert to electron volts. And when you do that, you will find that the kinetic energy of the electron is actually 13.6 electron volts. So if it takes a total of 26.9 electron volts to remove the electron from the hydrogen atom, and it already has 13.6 electron volts in kinetic energy at the time you try to remove it, then the ionization energy that you have to put in is really the difference between those two. So if we take the work that we calculated, the 26.9, and we subtract from that the kinetic energy of the electron, which we just calculated, the 13.6, we get the ionization energy of hydrogen should be 13.3 electron volts, which is pretty good. That's now really rather close to 13.6, so we should feel pretty good about that. And we didn't actually really need to know much about quantum mechanics. I mean, admittedly, we pulled out the Bohr radius and used that, but more or less, this is just a tiny bit of classical physics and Coulomb's law, and we can calculate the most important number in all of chemistry, basically, which is the ionization energy of hydrogen. See? So you should feel really good about that. Okay. So, hope things are going okay now. I'd like to move on to a slightly different angle on Coulomb's law. So we have talked about Coulomb's law as it works between two single charges, basically. So two discrete charges. But of course, the world is much more than two discrete charges. You might imagine having a whole collection of discrete charges and needing to understand what force they exert on some other poor little charge that happens to be in their area. So in order to calculate that, we really need to take advantage of the fact that Coulomb's law is a vector law, that the force of electrostatics is a vector force. So if you are on slide 8 and you look at the sketch that I have up at the top, let us ask, what is the force on charge little q, the little blue charge, due to a collection of discrete charges, say q1 and q2 and dot, 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 some qn. So we have some collection of n discrete point charges, Q1, Q2, Qn. And these discrete point charges are located at some random set of positions, but once they're settled, they are what they are. And Q1 is located, you can locate Q1 by vector little r sub 1 in the sketch. So that gives both a direction and a distance to charge Q1 from the charge little q, which is the one that where we're trying to calculate the effect of all of these other charges. Q2 is located at by vector r2 from little q. Qn is located by vector r sub n from little q. So if we look at the equation with the blue A, the net force on little q is going to be the vector sum of all of the forces. So we take each pair of charges, Q1 and little q, Q2 and little q, Qn and little q, and we calculate the vector force of each of those Q1, the forces due to Q1, Q2, and Qn separately. And then we sum them vectorially. And we can do this because it is electrostatics is a vector force. So the net force on Q is equal to the force on little q due to big charge Q1 plus the force on little q due to big charge Q2 dot 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 all the way up to Q sub n. So but it's a vector sum. So we now can rewrite the F sub Q1 and F sub Q2 and F sub Qn in terms of Coulomb's law. So we get the equation in the circle, the blue circle B. The net force on little q is KQ1 times little q over R1 squared along the direction R1, so we have R1 vector hat, plus KQ2 little q over R2 squared, R2 vector hat, plus all the way out to KQn little q times R sub n squared, R sub n vector hat. So it's so long as you can actually sum vectors together, then you can find the net force on little q due to some arbitrary distribution of discrete point charges. So we'll do some practice with that in the homework sets and the workshops, just to sort of, you need to always keep the vector aspect of this in mind. So just a reminder, the Coulomb applet, if you go on the class webpage and you look about halfway down, you'll see a series of links to different applets, which are fun to play with and instructive. And go to the one that says Coulomb and you can play with it. It basically will give you, it will show you the vector force between two charges where you can actually vary their distance and the magnitude of the charge and even the sign of the charge between them, and you can sort of see how to play how Coulomb's force works as a vector force. You can also add another charge, and that brings us to what's going on this slide. When you add other charges, you can see how the forces add vectorially. So I do want you to spend some time playing with that applet and get the hang of that and see how it demonstrates what you're seeing in at the bottom of page 8. Okay, so if you'll go now to page 9 in the slides. On page 9, what I'd like to do now is to consider a continuous charge distribution. So if we were to imagine that we have the little charge q, blue q, and let us also imagine that we have some continuous charge distribution, like this strange orange shape that I've drawn in the sketch on page 9. think of it as sort of a, you know, some sort of arbitrary shaped potato of charge, some sort of charge out there. And what I'd like to know is, what is the force of that distribution of charge on the little cue? And now life is a little bit difficult, because how do you take into account this big continuous distribution? And here comes the power of calculus. I mean, this is why calculus was invented, basically, is to take care of things like this. We don't know how to deal with this big distribution all at once. What we know is how to deal with a small point charge, right? So what we can do is to imagine that this big distribution of continuous charge is really made up of an extremely large number of very small, tiny point charges. We call them differential charges, little dQs. So if you look on page 9 in the sketch, you see that I've drawn a green dot at some arbitrary point in the orange charge distribution, and I've labeled it dQ. That's a differential piece of charge. No matter what is going on in that strange orange charge distribution, the charge could be varying dramatically as a function of position. dQ is a tiny little sliver of charge in a tiny little place. It is such a small little volume of charge that the charge doesn't vary across it in any measurable way. We call it a differential, right? It's a little tiny thing. So because of that, when we think of the charge within the orange blob as a little dQ, each little dQ we will consider as a point charge. So that means that we can write an expression of the force on little blue Q due to the differential charge dQ, and we can write that force in the same way that we've been writing it, just using Coulomb's law. So in the equation given to the side of the pink C in a circle, the force on little blue Q from due to the dQ is just K times Q times dQ. That's just KQQ, okay? Over the distance between them squared. I've chosen an arbitrary origin in this case, and I have represented the position of little blue Q due to by vector R sub Q, little Q. And I have noted the position of little dQ, which is in the orange blob, by vector R. Okay? So the vector that goes between dQ and little q is really the difference between the vectors R sub Q and R. So the magnitude of that difference is the distance between those charges. So that's what I've written in the denominator to the right of the equation given by the C in the pink C in a circle. And of course, if that vector is R sub Q minus R, if that's the vector, then the force on little q due to dq is along that direction. So I then have to multiply this whole quantity by the unit vector R sub Q minus R. Okay, so that's why we have the right-hand piece of the equation in the middle there. Now note that this isn't the total force of the orange distribution on little blue Q, right? It is a little tiny piece of force due to that little tiny piece of charge, little dQ. So we really can't call it a full force. We make note of the fact that it is due to the differential by calling it a differential force, or dF. So I don't really like calling it, I either have to call it F on Q due to this tiny little differential dQ, which makes note of the fact that it's a dQ, or I just call it dF. And so that's why I call it dF in that middle equation. Okay. Now the trick is, that is one little differential piece in this distribution, and what I'd really like to do is vectorially sum all of the possible little dq's in the distribution. And that basically means we want to integrate across all of those little differential charges. So the general expression for Coulomb's law near a charge distribution, so the total force on little blue q due to this orange blob is the integral, or the sum, over the infinity of little differential q's. So we take, the dfs, we sum over all those little differential f's vectorially. So if you look at what is inside the integral on the equation at the bottom of page 9, that is the same expression that we just found considering that one differential charge. But now we want to sum over all of them, which means we have to integrate. And we have to integrate over the full volume of charge. So we have to integrate over that entire volume of potato. Or you could think of it as we're actually integrating over the whole universe, but we're only considering the only charge that exists that we have to consider is what's inside that orange blob. So everything else, the dq is zero, so it doesn't count. So this is really the most general expression for Coulomb's law. And it allows you to calculate the force on a charge due to some arbitrary distribution of charge. And it sounds, it's sort of theoretical at this point. What do you really mean? Well, it becomes obvious when you think of a very particular charge distribution. So it isn't typical that you see it written like we have at the bottom, page 9. In fact, what you usually have is you have a charge distribution specified. So the differential dq, that you have the charge distributed in some volume. It could be in a volume like a potato. It could be along a surface like on a ball. It could be along a line. So, for example, you have a wire and you distribute charge along that. So there are some conventions. So typically what you have is not dq in the integral at the bottom of page 9. Typically you rewrite that integral dq in terms of the charge distribution times a differential volume. Or if it were a volume charge, so say in a potato, dq is equal to the volume charge density rho times the volume, but it's a differential volume, so you have a little dv. So dq is equal to rho dv. If you see rho, it basically means it's a charge distribution in three dimensions. It's a volume charge distribution. If you have the same thing, but you're on a surface, which we often will encounter in electromagnetism, dq is equal to sigma times dA. So sigma is the area charge density, which is in coulombs per meter squared. The volume charge density above in rho is coulombs per meter cubed. If we're considering a line charge, then it's a linear charge density. It's coulombs per meter. And dq is equal to lambda dL. The rho, sigma, and lambda basically is those symbols are chosen by convention. And again, lambda here does not mean wavelength, so don't get confused. It's the same as lambda as a wavelength, but it's not, because we're using an electromagnetism instead of talking about a waves. And of course, later in this class, we're actually going to be doing waves with wavelengths, and so we're going to have fun with that. At any rate, the general Coulomb force equation that you see at the bottom of page 10 is the same as what you saw at the bottom of page 9, except the dq is rewritten as rho dv. So we're assuming it's a volume charge instead of some area or linear charge. And the integral is done over that entire volume of charge. So a problem is usually given to you where the charge density, the charge volume distribution, the volume charge density function is described to you. So, for example, it could be the charge is in the form of a sphere, and it has a functional form of some sort of big Q over the radius squared, basically. And you probably have to do some normalization to get everything right, but basically you'll have a lot of charge toward the center, and then it would drop off as you get further out. If I say K over R squared, yeah, it's going to blow up at the center, so don't worry about that. I'm just pulling that out of thin air. At any rate, this is a very general equation and is sort of useless in the sense that it's so general. What happens in real life is you're given problems which actually have specific charge distributions, and then this equation sort of takes on some reality and something you can calculate. So let's go to page 11. Imagine that we have a charge Q, big Q, which is in the yellow charge off to the left of page 11. And let's say that we put a little charge, tiny Q, blue, over on the right-hand side. And if we make the assumption they have the same charge, so let's say they're both positive, then we know that big Q will exert a force on little Q, and I have denoted that force with the green vector F. What actually causes that force? I mean, what is the essence of the cause of that force? And you go, well, it's Coulomb's law, right? Well, yeah, Coulomb's law describes the force, sort of. Describes how it varies with charge and distance. What actually conveys the force? Yellow Q isn't touching little blue Q over there. What causes the force? Ponder that for a moment. It's a very deep question, in fact, and the answer to it depends a little on who you ask and how you ask it and what you mean. The area of quantum field theory and the standard model of particle physics can give you an answer and a description, but we're doing classical physics here, and we're going to make an assumption. We're going to pretend, so let's go to slide 12. We're going to pretend that yellow charge Q creates a condition in space, which we're going to call the electric field. And we will say that there will be a force on little charge Q placed at point P, which is equal to the magnitude of little Q times the electric field, whatever it is. So we're actually going to pull out of thin air, we're going to hypothesize that an electric charge actually changes the space around it. It creates a so-called electric field. And if we place another charge in an electric field, it will feel a force, and that force is equal to the electric field times that charge. Because charge is a scalar, just a quantity like temperature, the electric field basically has to be in the direction of the force. right? With the caveat that the charge could have a different sign. So if we assume everything's positive, the electric field will be in the same direction as the force. So the electric field, so what do we mean by field? Okay, a field is like a mapping of every point in space. So let's imagine that we consider the room that you're sitting in. You could imagine having a map of the temperature for every point in space in that room, and that we would call a temperature field, for example. A weather map that you see in a weather report on TV where they show a map of New York and they have the temperature in different cities, for example. The temperature, you can consider the temperatures they show in those different cities as discrete points within the overall temperature field, which is all of the points. And it shows how the temperature is varying from point to point. If we had a similar thing, but we were looking at wind speed and direction, for example, then you could symbolize the wind speed and direction at every point on the map with little arrows. The arrow pointing in the direction of the wind and the length of the arrow being given by the speed of the wind, for example. That would be a wind field. The electric field is more like a wind field. At every point in space, we assume that there is an electric field, and that electric field you can think of mentally as a little arrow whose direction points in the direction that a positive little test charge, if you were to place it there. We're going to talk a lot about test charges. So these aren't real charges. These are sort of mental charges that we imagine placing in different places to see what's going to happen. So you can imagine placing a little positive test charge at a point in space, and the electric field will give you the direction that the force will be on that little positive test charge. And the length of the arrow of the electric field, or the size of the electric field, will tell you the amount of force. So we can think of the electric field at a point as the force vector per unit charge for a little test charge that's placed at that point. So E, the electric field at point P, if we look in the middle of page slide 12, the electric field at point P is equal to the Coulomb force, F sub Q, on little q, the net force on it, divided by the magnitude of Q. So the reason that this little Q is a bit of a test charge is because it doesn't matter how big a Q we put at that point. We are dividing out its magnitude. So the electric field is a characteristic of the big yellow Q. It has nothing to do with what charge we put at point P. And this is one of the convenient reasons why we want to use electric fields instead of Coulomb's law all the time, because what I'd really like to do is to look at what yellow charge Q does to the space around it. How does it affect the space such that if I put another charge at that point in space, it will feel a force? So that's sort of this mental game that we're playing. So the electric field goes as KQQ over R squared, but we divide out one of the Qs. So the electric field at point P at a distance R away goes as KQ over R squared along R hat, where R hat is the vector going from yellow Q out to point P. This is the electric field for a point charge, big Q, basically. Is the electric field real? Well, we're going to talk a lot about that as the semester goes on, and perhaps you'll begin to believe in it as something real as the semester wears on. I think there's some good reason to believe that it might be. But for now, and for how it was invented, it's a calculational convenience. It's sort of a mental jump. Instead of always having to worry about two charges and the force between them, we ask, what is it that this one charge does to the space around it such that if I put a charge anywhere there, I'll feel a force? So by getting away from the two charge thing and actually asking what is the condition in space, what is this electric field in space around the single charge, we actually can map out the effect more of that single charge without worrying too much about how we're measuring it with what other things are involved. So there's a lot of power and convenience in tied up in this whole electric field idea, and you'll see that as we go along. Okay, so I think I have now talked long enough. So this is the end of the September 7th lecture for Physics 142, and I hope you have a good day or evening, whichever it is for you as you're listening to this. Bye.